So 2018 was, to say the least, an interesting year for the small cap market. The UK smaller company sector was the standout performer of the first quarter, with the highest proportion of funds delivering consistent returns to investors. But then, as we were chatting a bit beforehand, things went pear-shaped. What we're wondering is what led to this big change? Was it that high valuations in a growing sector led to then some sharp corrections? So joining me today to answer these questions for us is Peter Webb. Peter is a well-known investor and founder of Web360 Consultancy, where he uses his long-standing investment knowledge to guide his clients in the ever-changing small cap sector. So could you just give us a brief overview of what you saw happen in the small cap sector in 2018?
Yeah, I can do, Anita. It's been a very interesting time, actually. It was a very interesting year. I mean, personally, I think my funds continued to perform right towards the end of the year, but everything was affected in the final quarter and quite substantially, with some serious markdowns of both your international companies plus your domestics. It wasn't unusual to see basically sound small companies falling 25%. That seemed to be the norm. Very few companies bucked that. And so that's quite interesting and quite severe setbacks by past standards, and so sudden. But I think the reason it was so sudden is because, to a certain extent, there has been a bit of complacency creeping into the sector. I'd say that since the financial crisis, that the UK small company sector has been one of the biggest beneficiaries of new funds flow into the UK, without any doubt. The other thing is the economic environment has been so good. You know, quantitative easing, the lowering of interest rates, global growth has generally been pretty favourable to companies of all types and all sizes. But it's always leveraged into the small caps. They seem to, their operational sensitivity, that growth is always so much higher than the larger companies, and the profit growth as a result is so much better. So I think that things have been pretty good in the big picture, and that's driven the story. And the increased leverage, operational sensitivity of small companies to that growth has meant that their profitability has grown significantly greater than large companies. They've therefore attracted a significant flow of funds, which is only just started to slow, let's be honest about it. And I think it's fair to say that in some cases, sectors and industries got overvalued. Last year, increasing uncertainty in the UK over Brexit, whether or not the UK government that could take interest rates any lower, clearly couldn't. Things like the artificial assistance or the assistance into the housing market. These are all forms of easing that probably reached the point at which there was no further to go. And then internationally, we've seen some clear signs of problems looming in terms of the rate and pace of global growth and economy slowing down. We've seen Trump with the trade arguments with China. People are uncertain about that. And also, some of the big performers of the last couple of years in the UK, so the last bastions of growth, the internationals, which have benefited particularly in the UK from the weakness of sterling in terms of their competitiveness abroad, the translation of their dollar earnings into sterling. That started to break down as global growth started to slow. And people are talking about, well, late cycle investment, which comes at the late end of the cycle, and whether or not, that is actually in itself beginning the trend. And that's the message about the turn downward. So basically, there's not, the bad news has just suddenly hit, and it's so big across the piece that investors have lost their nerve. And I think particularly in the last few months, the downside in share prices is primarily being driven by private investors. I haven't seen significant institutional selling, but I have seen a lot of loss in the aggregate value of institutional investors' funds in small caps as they've sat there and they've seen the growth premium disappear.
I'm curious, you said there has been a sort of complacency. That's what you've seen.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you think it's because the market had been going so well that investors were willing to pay these higher valuations, and that's sort of where the complacency comes from? Or tell me more about that.
Well, I think the growth has been so good. You're absolutely correct. The growth has been so good. Look, why do you need to sell something that's doing well? And the fund flow has been so good. So what do? You sit in cash? I mean, you could argue that one has a rotation from growth to value, but value might be the lesser, higher multiple companies, but they might be primarily domestic, where the Brexit issue has been a bit of an overhang, right. So I think that investors have just stayed where they're at because the momentum's been good, been less than perhaps as sensitive to the valuations. and just continued to buy more. And I think, you know, I can see how it's come about that, but I just think that perhaps, you know, 12, 18 months ago, there should have been some repositioning of portfolios and money within the market, and that's probably not reflected in it today, with a big difference in valuations between what have recently been perceived growth companies and what I can call traditional value. So international versus domestic, there's still a big anomaly in pricing. Mm. So yeah, I think it's complacency merely because of flow of money and things were good.
Right. And now as we're seeing this sell-off, you said it was more in the private sphere than public institutions. Yeah. But as this sell-off continues into 2019, what is your advice for investors, private investors, trying to determine what an accurate valuation for a company or stock might be?
Personally, I'd say that at times like this, share price markdowns can be indiscriminate. Mm. What I would say to you is at the moment, we've not seen too many profit warnings. We've seen a number of companies saying, we're doing a little bit better in the second half than we did the first, which is normally a precursor, less an admission that things aren't as good. It's a sort of profit warning. And we are seeing, you know, one or two companies that have done things and deals that are perhaps not working out. But we're not seeing the weight of profit warnings you'd expect, but the market is telling you that something's going to happen. Mm. So we're no longer in a situation where we can just buy the piece.
Right.
So we have to now focus down and hunker down and say, well, in this environment where it's quite possible that through a combination of reduced confidence in growth company multiples and growth companies, and through a gradual reduction in profitability of many companies, that we are going to see share prices fall across the piece. I'm not predicting Armageddon, but what I'm saying is the big picture tells you that we're in for a bit of a troublesome period, and that the growth that's been achieved in recent years is not going to prove to have been sustainable. Right. And therefore, the share price ratings that were afforded to companies on the basis that that growth was sustainable are going to fail. You know, there's going to be some correction. So how do we combat this? Well, the key is we need to find sectors and businesses, or businesses operating sectors, that have the ability to deliver growth despite the very difficult big picture. Mm. And therefore, we're moving heavily from not a I own everything, or even particularly, you know, big positions in individual sectors, we're moving down to the stock-specific dynamics. So we've got to look through the market and sort the wheat from the chaff, and we've got to look for businesses that have business models or sell products and services for which there's still competitive edge and ability to grow, mechanisms that can deliver that growth in margins, profitability, sales, etc. We need to get sorting things out, you know, the wheat from the chaff. So from my perspective, I'd say it's pretty simple to me, having done this a few times, where we might look. Now, domestic to me, primarily because of the Brexit situation, is cheap as an asset class. And by that, I mean companies that predominantly sell their products into the UK. International, where if we do get any sort of resolution to the Brexit situation, we're likely to see a strengthening of sterling versus the dollar in particular and the euro, then that's going to have a bit of a knock-on in terms of the conversion of the earnings of our dollar earnings overseas into UK. It might take away some of that improved competitiveness that they've had the last few years. So I think the internationals are perhaps a little bit vulnerable. And also I'd say that because it's a fact that the internationals at the moment tend to be more highly rated versus domestics. And so the UK economy is a very interesting place to be for me. I also think that once we resolve the issues pertaining to Brexit, we may see, you know, untapped corporate activity. There's some wonderful market positions in the UK available for next to nothing at the moment. But they're being ignored because it's all been about momentum.
Right.
And companies that ain't growing that fast, don't have any momentum, are not perceived to have value. But of course, at times like now, you've got to say to yourself, it's not just about the growth rate, it is about the price earnings ratio, it's about the dividends, the assets, the cash flows, the value of those inherent market positions. So I think that the other traditional ways of looking at companies other than price earnings ratio are going to come to the fore. So the valuation of a company and the opportunities are going to be about a package of things which we haven't been used to looking at for some time, because it's all been about growth rates, it's all been about pegs. You know, price earnings to growth and price earnings ratio. So it's not been about dividends, it's not been about assets, it's not been about underlying cash flows or inherent market positions. It hasn't been the value of a business long-term to an acquirer, for example. So I think the pendulum is swinging. So it's stock picking, it's quite specifically domestic, which is where I think the value lies. and in those deep entrenched value judgments that we haven't seen for a long time. Because mm-hmm. growth has clearly been outperforming value for many, many years now. Mm-hmm. But the pendulum is definitely swinging. And I know that from my own experience in the last 12, 18 months in terms of how I position my portfolio. So where should we be? Well, from a personal perspective, I think the place to go is to find companies, well-managed companies, financially strong, that have the wherewithal, the product or service, and the opportunity within their markets to continue to grow. And I have a number of companies which I picked specifically on that basis. They're predominantly UK, they're domestic, they're in large markets but with plenty of scope, and they're all companies that have undergone some sort of change or going through some process that gives them edge in their market to deliver that growth that others won't have. They're all well supported by investing institutions, but they do stand out from the crowd, and I think they're all capable of driving forward. And I'm happy to talk you through some of those examples if you'd like to hear that. Well, I've picked three companies which I think are all interesting for their own peculiar reasons. In the bigger picture of growth, I think that at times like this, your buy and build companies have a great opportunity to grow when perhaps more cyclical companies or more companies dependent on one cycle or just what they have are going to be hit by the, you know, hit by the incoming tide, you know. Right. So I'm all for the buy and build story. So one of my favourite companies at the moment is AFH Financial, which is a wealth management business. It's a consolidator of the UK IFA market. It's valued about 150 million market cap at the moment. Last year spent just over 30 million on 16 acquisitions, typically paying about six times. Just went through the 5 billion under management barrier and 50 million of revenues. The long-term aim is to get that even higher and 20% EBITDA margins. This year, as all my three companies I'm going to recommend, they're all in low double-digit multiples. So, you know, 10s, 11s, 12s. They all pay good dividends with good levels of cover, and they're all financially strong. But AF Financial, Alan and Paul that run that business and have done so many years, they set about coming to public markets to exploit the anomaly that's out between a public market listing valuation and private company valuation. And they operate in what's a very fragmented market, the IFA market. Number of reasons in recent years, like increased need for IT investment, increased regulatory burden. The average age of IFA in this country is much older than most other industries as well. They set about consolidating that industry into their single AFH platform, which has all the IT resource you need. So when they buy, they get immediate synergistic benefits. And they've been doing this for a few years now, very successfully, significantly growing both the funds under management, the revenue and the profitability and the dividends. They're very well supported from institutions, having raised 30-odd million last year in terms of fundraisings for due deals. And they've got cash in the bank today. But that's a very fast-growing company in a very fragmented market, where the logic of what they're doing is so compelling. And in fact, not only are they experiencing growth through the acquisitions, they're experiencing significant organic growth as those IFAs are brought into their organisation and benefit from all the day-to-day responsibilities that distract them from doing the sales and business are taken away. So to me, AFH Financial is a really interesting business. It's a strong balance sheet, it's high growth, it's a very sensible rating relative to that growth. It's got immense potential to continue the acquisition mode. It's got a good, well-covered dividend. And I think, you know, 150 million, this one could become a very large company indeed. So I like AFH Financial, and I know the management team very well. I've known them for many, many, many years, which is always a positive to me, because that means I've had the benefit of visiting their offices in Birmingham, and I've had the benefit of many meetings with management over many years. So I have great comfort with that story. I like that. The second one I would recommend is PCF Group, a PCF Bank, Private and Commercial Finance Bank. That is a challenger bank. I've known the management of that company, Rob and Scott, since 1994 when they set up the original business. I've kept a close eye on it and held it for many years. And a couple of years ago, they got their banking license. And that's been quite transformational in terms of its potential. And I can tell you, back in the financial crisis, they had funding from Lloyds and Barclays. And believe me, did they get wavery about that funding? Yeah. You know, and it became very difficult. So getting their banking license and having access to retail funds for the first time is phenomenal. Because what it's enabled them to do is significantly lower the cost of capital into their business model. Now, PCF Bank essentially is a lender to businesses for plant, equipment and vehicles. It's a lender to consumers for vehicle purchases. And they recently made an acquisition of Azul that takes them into asset finance in the broadcast and media industry. It's about a 50 million book. So last year, in their first year as a bank, they took retail deposits up to almost 200 million. Their lending book to over 200 million, which is a significant growth on the previous year, over 50%. Delivered fantastic growth in the numbers. It's a 75 million market cap with 40 million net assets, which is quite interesting. It's got a capital ratio first tier of 19%, so it's got some more to go on that. But basically, that business, through the acquisition, the access to retail deposits, which has increased its, or lowered its cost of capital in, has enabled it to go into more prime business in its key markets and become more competitive. And those markets are very, very big indeed. They're billions of pounds, okay? We're only lending 200 at the moment. We've got targets to go to 350 million in a fairly short time. And our returns on capital are over 10 at the moment. We think getting up to 12.5. So basically, this is a low double-digit multiple looking forward, strong asset backing. There's a good divvy, a great cover. It's a new challenger bank. Its margins have improved because of lower cost of capital, but we've been able to improve the quality of the business because we've been able to give away a little bit of that margin to go more into prime. The acquisition of Azul brings them the opportunity to pay 6 million quid for that, gives them the opportunity to get 50 million lending through that platform. And now they've announced the plans to go into the bridging market, although I know they're going to do that in a very sensitive and gentle way. And the property market is significant in terms of the funding potential. So basically, this is a small but beautifully formed challenger bank with a number of incumbent market positions on which it has, you know, it does particularly well, which are scalable, and some new adjuncts and avenues to move into, which will only continue to serve to drive further our profitability next 2 or 3 years. And I think that company, given the scale of the market, will continue to grow whatever happens in the bigger picture.
Interesting.
You know, particularly given that the major banks have never fully recovered the positions they had post the financial crisis. I mean, they have closed so many branches, closed down so many personal relationships, retired so many bank managers, that actually there's huge swathes of the financial market that are not being serviced by what were traditional banks. And these are the market opportunities that challenger banks are here to exploit and will continue to do so. So PCF is a very interesting business. And I say, you know, I like that one too. And then finally, another interesting business. And I say this because the market it serves, there's only one way the demand is going, and it's up. And the truth about it is the more our society grows by number, the more people are in need of the services that they offer. And they're a special care services provider. It's called CareTech. It's a 350 million market cap company. And they just recently completed the acquisition of a major competitor called Cambion. Now, CareTech operates in adult services, and it also has some children's services, but predominantly adult. And children, these are children that really can't cope in society on their own. They might have learning difficulties or fostering, but they need care. Now, Cambion is very complementary, predominantly children's services, and it does education and schooling as well. But this was a merger of two of the top 10 special care service providers in the UK. Very complementary in terms of the services they're offered, and very complementary geographically. And the deal does bring quite substantial synergies. I think that at the early stages that the management have highlighted over the next 2 or 3 years, 6 million annualised synergy, just for not having two public companies. So it's quite interesting. Now, the fact is the combination of the two makes the number two care provider in the UK, but it's still tiny. In a 12 billion per annum market, it's doing 350 million turnover. The management team at CareTech have been on the market many, many years, and I've known them that time, and they're very astute at what they do, the Sheikh family. And basically, you know, they've done a great job with CareTech, bringing it up from nothing on its first flotation on the market to be the substantial business it is today. I think combined business this year is estimated to do something like 89 million EBITDA. So basically, and we've got over £7.50 net assets against a £3.30 share price. Now, it is a leveraged business model because the nature of the assets and the recurring nature of the income, which is predominantly local authority, where there's big, big funding increases being forecast up to 2020 and beyond 2025, I think it is. The nature of that means that you've got security of your income. So they do run a leveraged business model. So in fairness, you know, they're a 350 million market cap, probably slightly less, and they've got a similar amount of debt, but they've got huge interest cover on that 90 million EBITDA. But it just makes the debt makes the the business model work just more efficiently. So basically what you've got here is you've got the second largest specialist care services provider in the UK, which is undoubtedly a growth market as more and more people come onto this planet in the UK as well, let's call it a small planet, that actually just aren't able to cope. Yeah. And they provide a whole range of services which really deals with issues in society and tries to help these people, adults, young people and children, to really get back into normal life the best they possibly can. Some never can, unfortunately, but that's what they do. They have 400 homes of various kinds. They have 9,000 staff as confirmation, wow, and they look after 4,000 people. But, you know, it's just an unfortunate fact of life.
Right.
The more people we have on this planet and the more we have in this UK, the more there are demands. And it's not only that, you only got to look at the press and see the issues we have anyway. We still know that the pressures on government to deal with mental illness and needs for people that can't function correctly. You know, I think there's unsatisfied demand there. I think the combination of the businesses is really, really interesting. And under the stewardship of the Sheikh family, who so successfully developed CareTech, we've got a real winner there. Low tens multiple, a very good divvy with great cover. Now, there's indigestion in the market post the deal. There's a bit of a competition authorities look at the deal. I think these are factors that mean that the share price is somewhat more depressed than it might otherwise be. There was significant director buying, CareTech director buying post the deal at much higher than today's prices. So I think if you look at it, you've got CareTech, you've got a big acquisition. The combination looks really exciting, but you've got a depressed share price because of various factors at the moment. But I think the potential in that is quite substantial. And I think the market drivers are significant longer term. You've got AFH with its compelling buy and build model, which it's done so well with to date, hitting all its targets with great institutional support. You know, that market is still so fragmented. Bigger deals are coming available now. You know, a lot of these IFAs are coming to retirement. You know, they don't want to cope with the investment. They don't want to put the investment so near to their retirement. They're happy to snugly move into a bigger group, have it all done and enjoy the last few years. And I think PCF, great management team. I think it's theirs to win, you know. So I think all three companies there, if they don't succeed, it will be their doing, it won't be their market.
Right.
And I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
And so that raises two questions for me. One is, say, you know, I'm a private investor in 2019. What it sounds like is that my best bet is to look very closely at how scalable or how competitive the service that the company is providing.
Yeah.
What is the difference, though, there between what my strategy would have been in 2018? What about 2019? What should I be doing differently?
Well, let me say, I think in 2017, you could have owned just about everything that went up.
Okay.
But in 2018, you got much more discerning. So certainly we've seen the disengagement from your big growth to you and your domestic. So your internationals, your domestic in the first half of last year. So we saw a disengagement there. And by that, what I mean is that UK domestic companies have begun to perform far less well, particularly since we saw the potential downturn in the housing market, which was probably the year, probably 17. So basically, I think a lot in the UK is driven by consumer demand. You know, naturally things can get saturated if you give it too easy.
Right.
You know, everybody has all the things they want and people get cautious about overpaying. So I think the UK slowdown has probably been happening since 2017, possibly slightly earlier, particularly in the housing market. And I think that's been slow to work through to motors and to retail, etc. But there's an underlying caution in the UK consumer.
Of course.
I think that's, and obviously the press doesn't help. The internationals have really tumbled in the last 6 months or so, and that's really been a combination of things. But certainly in more recent months, we've seen a clear indications of a global slowdown in terms of expenditure. And I think that's been cautionary. And I think investors have been looking from a UK point of view about sterling and where do we go if there is a deal. You know, the competitive position of UK exporters is likely to be less good on any sort of deal because the sterling's been so depressed. So I think investors are starting to look a little bit ahead. So what has changed? Well, we've seen a significant setback in all small companies in the last few months.
Mm-hmm.
Right, now that is something that a lot of fund managers today have never seen in their lives because they only come into fund management post the financial crisis. And to be honest, a lot of the experienced fund managers have been doing so well in funds under management, they don't really have to manage. They haven't had to manage. They just buy more of what they own because it goes up. And of course, there's a combination reason it goes up, because the numbers are good, because they're buying more.
Yeah.
Okay. So why have we got to be different? Because we've got to understand that the reason things are as they are and been acting as they are is because there's going to be some disappointment. Mm. We can no longer rely on the sector going up. And the truth about it is there's still got a lot of the forecasts out there in the market for growth in particular are going to prove to have been too high. Mm. I think it's going to be quite remarkable if many companies, if they're going to be able to repeat the earnings of the last couple of years, this year and
next.
Right,
that doesn't seem like it's going to be the case.
Now, at the moment, people still think there's going to be growth. Mm. But from my point of view, I think we've got to be realistic here. The big picture tells me that companies are going to struggle to do what they did the year before.
Right.
Never mind beat it. And of course, investment's been all about price versus growth. It's all been about growth, hasn't it? And momentum. Well, what momentum is there when companies don't deliver growth? That's right. Not a buzz, that's a zub. That's what they say, isn't it? Put it in reverse. So I think we're in a quite a telling time. Mm. A lot has changed.
Right.
And I think the pendulum is swinging very, very rapidly in favour of value, albeit you won't see it. The reason it's not that investors are buying value, it's just they're selling growth. So the relative position of value when growth is being sold improves as a percentage of the whole. But what I think is going to emerge is that some of the value companies, and particularly domestic, some of the companies I've been talking about you today, what they can deliver actually is the characteristics of growth that have been overlooked because they were domestic.
Interesting.
Quite interesting. So I think we're in for, there's going to be a shuffling of the pack.
Right.
And I think it's value versus growth. It's domestic versus international. And I'm firmly of the view that the real inherent value in small cap markets today lies in domestically focused, that is, British companies. That's where we have not so much growth, but we have low ratings, great cash generation, good asset backing, potential. We have strategic potential. We have corporate M&A potential. Once the Brexit uncertainty clears, there's no doubt that the news I hear from Germany and France, they're gagging to get hold of British businesses, as are the Americans too. Once we get some certainty, whatever that is, I expect those valuations of some of our good British businesses not to last.
Right.
And money has to be somewhere, because fund managers will not sit on cash, because the investors will take it off them. So as odd as it is, this is part of the reason we are where we are. Fund management in small companies has had so much capital inflow since the financial crisis. Mm. Essentially, it's driven the share prices higher. Are they going to give it back? They're obviously losing some of it in capital values, but are they going to give it back? It has to be applied somewhere. Are they going to buy stocks that are falling? They're going to try and buy defensively. And defense is the type of companies I've been recommending. So definitely things are changing.
And my last question, you're saying obviously Brexit is a major factor in the decision making, but what other macro events or trends would you keep an eye on in the upcoming year to make? Well, you know, it might be different because you said a focus on domestics, but obviously the influence is still there. What are one or two macro events you would keep an eye on?
Well, just thinking out loud, I mean, the interest rates would normally be a factor. Mm. Are they going up? I don't think so. So that might be a factor. What about government's interference in markets? It's already saturated the housing market in terms of the impact it can do from a bottom-up perspective. I suppose on a bigger picture, if you look at America, what's the issues there with Trump? The trade wars with China? I mean, I happen to think, you know, notwithstanding the fact that I think internationals are expensive, I think the US market is one of the few that looks quite interesting. And obviously a lot of things that are happening in the States internally will have a dramatic potential for an improvement in the dynamics of that economy if they start repatriating business, etc. So I think that's an interesting dynamic, but it's a shame, but we won't be doing that here, will we?
Yeah.
So what do I think in here? So back, I don't personally think that there's major things that are gonna happen here. You know, we're where we're at because economic cycles are like that.
Right.
Brexit has further deflated prices of domestic assets, which is an anomaly, which will unwind at some point. And we are late economic cycle globally, which means that the businesses, our international particularly, which are focused on investment spend, they are naturally going to wane as late cycle investment peters out, as it always does. So I, you know, other than that, it's difficult to be specific about factors. You know, I think the trend's your friend.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for coming and chatting with us about it. It is hugely useful to hear your insights into the matter. So thank you so much.
Thank you for the time.
Of course. Okay.